Hey folks, before we start the show, I wanted to tell you about a deal that we're offering Energy Gang listeners this week. You've heard us talk about our premium service, Squared, over the last few months. GTM Squared gives you bonus content like deeper features, analysis from our researchers as they digest the news, a yearly survey, discounts to our conferences, and another podcast called The Interchange, which we've played a few times for you now. We are offering you, our devoted listeners, a $50 discount to Squared. If you go to greentechmedia.com/squared and use the promo code podcast, you'll get $50 off a yearly Squared membership. And now on to the show. For the week of February 25th, 2016, this is the Energy Gang from Green Tech Media. The Google-owned smart home company Nest is under scrutiny. In the wake of multiple glitches that screwed with Nest thermostats this winter, there are now reports of unrest within the company. We'll talk about whether these issues are really that big of a deal. Then we'll look at what the sudden passing of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia means for Obama's climate plan. We'll end with a conversation about off-grid renewable energy markets. We published a piece at GTM arguing that solar can't help developing countries leapfrog the grid. We'll debate the findings. I'm Stephen Lacey, your guide through the week's clean tech news. Catherine Hamilton and Jigar Shah are my co-hosts. Catherine's in Washington with 38 North Solutions. Although you were supposed to be in Boston today.
That's right. I was so looking forward to actually seeing you in person. But unfortunately, the weather played tricks on us all, and I am here in D.C.
Jigar is in New York, where he just stepped out of a board meeting to join us. How are you, sir?
Doing well. I wouldn't miss it.
Well, let's kick off today's show with a conversation about Nest. I think the last time we talked about the company was when researchers showed they could hack a Nest thermostat last March, although the reality of that was that someone needed physical access to the device. Nest is back in the headlines with some less than positive press. In January, the New York Times reported on a software glitch that left an untold number of customers in the cold after it suddenly drained their thermostat batteries. A week later, Fortune's Stacey Higginbottom wrote a story about other glitches that were causing Nest thermostats to act erratically when connected to other smart home devices. And earlier this month, Business Insider reported on internal frustrations within the company, quoting former employees who said teams were working way overtime and facing unrealistic deadlines. This sparked a bunch of anonymous posts from people claiming to be former employees or current employees complaining about CEO Tony Fadell's management style. This, in turn, sparked responses from other Nest employees who took to the web to talk about their positive experiences at the company. Nest itself is not commenting. So how much credibility should we give these reports? And more importantly, what does this whole series of issues say about the difficulties in the smart home sector? So Jigar, I guess I'll turn to you firstly on the more speculative stuff. How much stock do you put into the complaints from anonymous employees about the company?
Very little. I mean, I think that, you know, look, where Nest is right now is in a place where they're selling tens of thousands of units on a regular basis. They've got major utility companies doing rollouts. You've got a lot of consumer interest in their products, not just the thermostat, but also the smoke alarm, et cetera. You've got insurance companies that are working closely with them to figure out how to roll this out. I mean, you know, the fact that they've got glitches, I mean, that's sort of par for the course. I think the real question is, you know, whether the company is fundamentally, you know, imploding because people don't really like their products. I don't know that a lot of the folks that are complaining are removing their Nest thermostats and replacing them with, you know, Honeywell's latest smart thermostat offer.
No, we saw some complaints around the glitches, but we have not seen a lot of customers rush to other products. So you're right about that. And then related to the complaints from former employees, many of them talked about how Nest was requiring them to work on weekends way overtime, that they were backed up with their work, that they faced unrealistic expectations. And this sounds exactly like what Apple went through when they were designing the iPod. So I'm having trouble figuring out why this is any different from some other major consumer products, most notably the iPod. It's not really that different. And Nest is paying so close attention to detail. It sounds like it's demanding a lot of its employees, but that's par for the course for a lot of consumer tech companies.
Yeah, I talked to somebody inside Nest, and they said, we feel like this is kind of old news that maybe a year or two ago, there were some issues, mostly because they just couldn't hire fast enough. They were in temporary space. They were trying to roll things out, and now it's settled down quite a bit. It just seems that this is one of the characteristics of a startup when you're trying to get something to market.
Like Tesla has the same issue, right? I mean, you can complain all you want about Tesla and how hard charging Elon Musk is and how he's hard on people, but then would you rather go to Ford? I mean, the same thing's true at Nest, right? It's like you can complain all you want, but would you rather go work for Honeywell?
I think that is such a good comparison.
So, like, I think things are fine. I think, you know, yes, are they competing at the same level as, you know, a normal internet company? No, but they're far exceeding the expectations of an infrastructure company that we're generally, you know, dealing with. So my sense is that the only thing that matters to me is if consumers of Nest products are finding them to be underwhelming and are leaving Nest in groves towards their competitive smart thermostats like Ecobee or Honeywell or some of the other competitors. And I don't hear that at all.
So. I do not hear that at all either.
Yeah, one thing that I'm curious about is on the policy side, of course, which is kind of how do you get thermostats, which, you know, are not in and of themselves smart unless they have some kind of something to make them smart, recognized as legitimate efficiency technologies, allow them to really participate as we move forward into kind of a much more seamless grid where supply and demand sides kind of coexist. And I mean, I think Nest is probably very well positioned to do so. I just think we need to put some policy provisions in place in order for them to really be able to take advantage of that.
So I talked to Brad Davids about this, who, you know, used to be at Enernoc and now is, you know, running that particular business development piece for Nest. And, you know, he's finding a ton of traction within the retail energy providers who are offering Nest for free in exchange for being able to control them in Texas and those places. But, you know, finding very, very slow adoption, which is what we would expect within regulated utilities. And I don't know that regulated utilities are going to move any faster.
Well, on that front, I think that there is an issue here as well, right? If you have these glitches, this is what makes regulators and utilities nervous. Even if it only impacts a small number of customers, they want to have total control of reliability. They want to know that these thermostats are on and controllable at all times. And so even if this was a short-term glitch, the optics are not good.
I don't think it's one for one, though. I mean, no. So let's say they had no glitches. I mean, do you think the utilities would work 10 times faster? No. So I don't know that the timeline has changed whatsoever because of the glitches. My sense is that they're just going to get a lot more traction out of the retail electricity providers like Direct Energy or Just Energy or Ethical Electric or others who are just more nimble.
Well, and I think that as long as you can quantify with data, which they are collecting lots and lots of data to prove out what you are actually accomplishing with that equipment, then I think that will help prove to the regulators that it's something that they can trust and count on when they think about energy savings.
Yeah. I think there's a bit of an optics and expectation problem here, but not much. And I agree with you, Jigar, that customers are not changing their buying habits in droves because of this issue. I think Nest actually is pretty smart for not commenting on this too. So let's move on and talk about the Supreme Court. This month has been a monumental one for environmental issues at the Supreme Court. On February 9th, the Supreme Court froze implementation of President Obama's landmark climate rule until a lower court ruled on its legality. Environmental groups worried the stay would delay implementation of the Clean Power Plan, leaving it vulnerable to state challenges and a potential Republican presidency in 2017. And then just 4 days later, an even more shocking development. Conservative Justice Antonin Scalia died in his sleep. Scalia was appointed to the Supreme Court in 1986 by Ronald Reagan, and over the decades he's proved to be one of the most conservative on the high court, sticking to an originalist interpretation of the Constitution. With only 8 justices now at the Supreme Court and Republicans vowing to block any Obama appointee, everyone's trying to figure out what will happen to the climate rules currently being considered by a D.C. district court. Catherine, how did things change after the death of Antonin Scalia?
Well, there are several categories of things. One is simply process. So on the process side, you're left with an even number of justices, which means that if you have the way you would see a split 4-4 on more conservative versus more liberal leaning justices, although Kennedy, who falls into the more conservative, is a little bit of a wild card still. And Roberts has also been. So I think, you know, you have less of a clear line between them. But if you have 4-4, you're set up for a tie. Now, what a tie can do for you is they don't like to tie, because if they tie, it sort of shows an abdication of making a decision, a real clear decision. And so it would just revert to whatever the circuit court decides. So if the circuit court decides to uphold the Clean Power Plan and the Supreme Court ties, then it's upheld. You know, if it falls along those kind of traditional left-leaning versus right-leaning lines, it could easily tie. So if you remember with Order 745, Alito had to recuse himself, and we still had an 8-judge panel, which came out 6-2. But again, there was the issue of what happens if they tie and it reverts to the circuit court's decision. So now you're in a position where that could happen all the time. So that's the process piece, is that's the kind of thing that can happen. The politics has just gotten nutty. So, you know, the president is required to nominate somebody, and the Republicans have said they won't consider anybody. So they're going to try to block consideration. I mean, to the point of they won't even meet with the president to talk about this at all. And it almost doesn't matter who he nominates at this point. They've said we're going to block anything. Well, in turn, what can happen, of course, is the Democrats can then block anything that the Republicans want to get done for the rest of this year and until the election. And I just think this creates just kind of an untenable situation, a traffic jam that's going to be really tough to get out of. I'm not really sure what's going to end up happening.
So I just think that we're creating a lot of drama where there is no drama as an energy gang sort of contributor. As an American, I get the fact that this is the height of drama. But from an energy perspective, yes, there's some bills in the House and Senate that may get delayed because of the back and forth, but they may have gotten delayed for other reasons. But I think on the Supreme Court, this goes two different ways. So on the environmentalist side, they get the Republican-Democrat divide. But as a business person, the Republicans have generally been very pro-business. And so I don't see how, like, you know, that from a business perspective, we're going to get hurt by the Supreme Court. So I just think that at this point, with the 5-year extension of the tax credit, I think even Brad Plummer has said that this may not actually matter all that much because we're going to get the clean energy one way or the other. We'd love for the clean power
plant. I don't know that he said that. I think he said the opposite, that there are a lot of states that aren't really moving that are going to be developing plans specifically because of the clean power plan.
Oh, but the tax extenders certainly are a good medium-term boost. But today, the Rhodium Group put out a report that said, you know, they've analyzed that if the CPP is struck down, they expect about 92 gigawatts of utility-scale wind and solar. But if it is upheld, it could grow to 142 gigawatts. So certainly, the clean power plan forces states that would not normally move and won't move as long as they don't know what's going on to move. There are a lot of states who will continue to move, and we know that. And so those will be the ones where they'll get better economic development, they'll get better investment in the state, they'll get more renewables, and maybe that will then force the other ones to join just for the economic benefits.
Yeah, I also think that this is the centerpiece of the Obama administration's climate plan, and they went to Paris and said, look at what we're doing here. If this gets implemented, we are going to be a leader in climate action. And when you have those seeds of doubt sown, it does impact the way countries view their voluntary actions. So right. I think that there's a lot of drama here, both in the American political system and when you look at the international climate negotiations.
Right, but I don't think that the Supreme Court was against the CPP. The only reason that they put the stay on the CPP is because the EPA gloated about the fact that around mercury, that even after it was struck down, that most of the coal plants had already made the upgrades. And so that gloating is the reason why the complainants in that case were able to make their case that we shouldn't let EPA get away with doing that again with CPP. But I don't think that the Supreme Court was signaling that they were actually against the CPP.
I don't know. I mean, I think that stay, just issuing the stay itself, does tell us that perhaps the 5 justices who are conservative might have struck it down, right? So that included Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, Kennedy, who is the wild card, as you said, and Alito. And now the dynamics have changed.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think they need to hear the merits of the case. I think that's what they want to know. And I think it's a little bit of what Jigar said, which is they kind of want to hear EPA, you know, make its own case and say why what they did was within what they had been directed to do in Massachusetts versus EPA, and, you know, how it is meets with the letter of the law. So I think we don't really know how it's going to shake out. And I don't know that it will shake out the way you would along traditional lines.
Right. And so all that's where I'm saying the drama is manufactured, right, is that ultimately I think EPA did a good job of covering all of its legal bases to try to find a provision within the existing law that they could use to do this. And, you know, and then now the Supreme Court will judge whether they did it properly. But I just think that, you know, that from a clean energy perspective, I don't think that the Supreme Court is anti-clean energy.
They certainly were not on Order 745. I mean, it was a 6-2 decision.
Right. So, like, yes, do I think that this is highly dramatic from a, you know, American citizen perspective? Absolutely. But from as a clean energy entrepreneur, you know, I don't know. I mean, like, for instance, this article that was written by Elena Shore about Sri Srinivasan and how he represented ExxonMobil when he was in private practice.
Yeah, so Sri Srinivasan is one of the D.C. District judges who is a potential nominee for a Supreme Court justice to replace Scalia.
Right. So what we're saying here by this article is that environmental groups may not like him because he represented ExxonMobil and former Enron CEO Jeff Skilling as a private practice lawyer. But everyone who's ever watched Law and Order knows that, you know, people are entitled to a fair trial. So just because people don't decide to go work for, you know, Earth Justice for a living doesn't mean that they're anti the environment. It just means that they had to, you know, like, provide the best defense possible for their clients. And so I don't know that Sri Srinivasan is anti renewable energy. And more importantly, when he's actually, you know, once he got onto the DC, you know, Court of Appeals, he's actually adjudicated a few cases that actually went the environmentalist way. So I just think that this is something where, because of our 24-hour news cycle or whatever it is, we're just now starting to overanalyze these things.
Well, they're also floating the name of Brian Sandoval, the governor of Nevada, the Republican governor of Nevada, who is a former federal judge and is a centrist on all kinds of issues. I think it's really interesting that they're floating that, because it's sort of like, let's put this out there and see what happens. And in the end, you know, of course, like, everybody's going to think that's a bad idea on both sides because he is centrist. But
so I don't know that that's true, Catherine. The reason why I don't think the Supreme Court thing is actually going to drag out is because I actually think that Obama's got the upper hand here, right? Basically, if he puts his natural selection, which is a centrist, on the court, whether it's Sandoval or Sri Srinivasan or many other folks who've been confirmed previously 96-0, then you have a centrist on the court. And if a Democrat actually wins the presidency in November, then they're going to put in a, you know, pro-choice person on the court and overturn everything that Scalia held dear. I think from the Republicans' point of view, they're going to see how this campaign goes. But if Donald Trump wins the nomination, my sense is that the Republicans could be like, crap, maybe we should confirm a centrist.
If say Hillary Clinton got the presidency and the Senate remained Republican, she's not going to be able to put through a liberal. She's going to still have to go with the centrist.
I think you'd be shocked at what she could put through, regardless of what the Republicans have on the at the Senate. I think to leave the Supreme Court empty, the president has the upper hand, and this is said in the Constitution, and, you know, in the spirit of Scalia, this is one of the rights that's clearly, you know, given to the president, with the Senate providing advice and consent. So I think the Republicans are playing with fire here. I think that they should take a centrist over trying to, you know, roll the dice and figure out what happens. Because, by the way, the Senate could flip to the Democrats as well, right? And so, and that would make it even worse. It just seems like they shouldn't play with fire.
Well, that brought me to my final point, which was, in all of this, the election is still probably the most important factor here in this whole piece of drama.
Yeah, it is.
For the Supreme Court. I mean, I don't know that it matters all that much for clean energy.
Well, yeah, but for the CPP, I mean, if you have a Republican president, it doesn't matter what the Supreme Court rules. They're going to try to dismantle this program in any way they can. So
it depends.
It comes down to
Donald Trump is a is basically Stephen Colbert on steroids. I wouldn't be surprised if the guy was a liberal if he gets elected president.
Well, I think that there's drama here. Let's talk about our third and final topic. We hear the cliche term leapfrogging over and over when talking about developing countries. Cell phones helped developing countries leapfrog fixed-line telephony, and technologies like solar will help them leapfrog the traditional electric system as well, say many. But will they really? Dr. Catherine Wolfram of the Haas Business School at the University of California, Berkeley, recently conducted a survey of 2,500 homes in Western Kenya with two other researchers. They found that homeowners with solar are demanding appliances that far exceed the capabilities of their solar systems. 75% of the homeowners are also still using kerosene to light their homes. There was only a 50-cent per month decrease in expenditures on kerosene on average among solar owners who were surveyed. So in a piece posted at GTM a while back, Dr. Wolfram concluded that technologies like solar are, quote, best described as incremental steps up the energy ladder rather than leapfrogging. Jigger jumped into the comment section to express his displeasure with the piece. So Jigger, this survey appears to show the limitations of distributed energy compared with connecting people to a centralized grid. Why do you disagree with the findings and the tone so vehemently?
You can pick apart every person's sentences and try to find, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. But I think that if you allow me to back up for a second, this is a systematic intellectual foray that we're fighting against, right? So this is not like one person's piece or, you know, Bill Gates's miracle pill comments, you know, in the last few days. It's really about the systematic piece, right? So let me start with TED, right? So when you think about the TED, you know, talks and the TED, you know, get-togethers that just finished in Vancouver recently, you know, there's a guy named Hans Rosling. And Hans basically is this guy who has these magical charts where the dots move and he shows that people are getting out of poverty and all is well with the world. He has a talk really about how the washing machine is the most magical data point, right? That when people get a washing machine, that's when women are truly empowered and folks really move from poverty to the middle class, right? And so based on that talk and all of the other sort of disparate data points, people like Catherine are sort of piling on to these things and saying, well, you know, we need to make sure that people have access to modern energy. And you see that out of Morgan Bazilian and at the World Bank and Condé Nkela with the energy work at the UN. And the challenge with this intellectual framework, which Bill Gates, you know, goes into hook, line, and sinker, is that you still have 1.3 billion people around the world or more who don't have access to modern energy and have not ever gotten access to modern energy in the last 50 or 60 years, even though grid extension has been the way in which people have talked about giving these people access to energy for the past 50 or 60 years. And so now that solar lanterns are finally solving this problem through all of the startup companies we know, as well as the manufacturing companies like D-Lite, et cetera, folks are saying solar is not good enough. We have to get them the washing machine. And none of us are saying that we're anti-washing machines. What we're saying is that for the love of God, like, allow these solar entrepreneurs a few years to make progress where the World Bank has failed miserably for 50 years before you start beating on them about the fact that they're not giving people access to washing machines.
Yeah, so I think your last point was correct. But I also think that the folks who make this argument about modern energy are also not saying that solar isn't a good solution, but that it's not the end-all solution. And so they're just arguing from a completely different perspective, but they're not arguing against solar necessarily.
Oh, they absolutely are. So this is what's happening is that people like myself have so beaten up Dr. Wolfram and Bill Gates and others that they have changed their talking points because they don't want to get beat up by me and others. And so now when you see the first inklings of this in 2013 or 2012 from Björn Lomborg, you know, Gates is basically taking that all the way. And Dr. Wolfram's the same, by the way. So her first piece, which this is like her fourth piece, her first piece basically says there's all these people who live just like, you know, a stone's throw away from the grid who are not yet connected to the grid, and we should connect those people. But she doesn't recognize the fact that those people are being denied access to electricity on purpose because, you know, companies like Eskom in South Africa don't believe even installing a meter to connect those people to the grid that's over their house is worth the money. Right. And so this is an evolution in their talking points because they realize that they don't want to get beat up by people like myself.
Yeah. And you have to start somewhere. I mean, if you have people who have nothing and you have to give them something, you give them this, it's not actually a leapfrog. It's more of really just a step. And then you can move on to bigger and better things. I was looking at what PowerHive has done in KCI, Kenya, on all these microgrids, which are really bringing communities together. And they're finding that with rural electrification, that this works really well. They have 4 pilot sites. They have a stable risk, predictable revenue streams. They feel like this is great growth potential. EarthSpark in Les Anglais, Haiti, is doing the same thing with microgrids. But you have to start with something. Why deny people the ability to have some form of electricity when the grids are just not going to get built? And what it sounds like she wants is to build central station grids the way we have in the U.S. And that is probably not the smartest way to go.
Yeah, it's actually the dumbest way to go. I mean, it's important for everyone just to say that. The cost of the grid today connected to central station power plants are about 2 times more expensive than microgrids and distributed generation. Right. And I just think that it's important for us to actually cause and create drama and conflict here where, you know, folks are trying to be more civil here because people's lives are at stake. I mean, people are absolutely damning people to poverty through their words.
But I don't think that Dr. Wolfram would say that a microgrid would be inferior. You know, she's saying, I challenge the energy community to come up with something that's superior. So if a microgrid can provide that level of service that the centralized grid can, then I'm sure she would support it. This intellectual argument does have consequences. It impacts the way people think about how they should be deploying capital in large international financial institutions and among an emerging class of venture investors. But I also think that we're kind of saying the same thing here and that we're drawing battle lines where they don't need to be drawn. And the folks who are talking about modern energy are not necessarily saying that solar is bad. And the folks who are saying...
No, they are necessarily saying that solar is bad. Stephen, like, stop with the bullshit. These guys have, have real documents, real articles that they published in 2012 and 2013 that are saying that it's not worth giving them solar at all, that it's better to make them wait for the grid. And now the fact that we beat up on them in 2012 and they've basically softened their pitch doesn't make them any more wrong. We have 1.3 billion solar lanterns to get out there so that people don't have to give birth to a child by cell phone light. I mean, it's just maddening to think about what we're talking about here. The implications of this intellectual argument are profound. And I, for one, would love to just get people access to basic light, electricity, and cell phone charging by 2020, which we have the possibility to do. And then all of us can work on microgrids from 2020 to 2025. And then we can think about whether those microgrids can be large enough to actually support washing machines. But for the love of God, like, this is a real conflict.
You know, I don't think that the people without energy are going to listen to you and say, oh yeah, I'll wait until 2025 to get my refrigerator. People want it now.
Yes, and they are getting it now with solar lanterns. They are not
They're not getting a refrigerator.
They are not going to get a refrigerator between now and 2025, no matter what Catherine Wolfram, and no matter what Bill Gates says, because neither one of them are doing crap to get them solar lanterns or modern energy. Right. And so this is purely intellectual for them. They don't give a rat's ass. They're not doing anything on the ground. So I do take this personally.
Well, we knew this conversation would be quite intense, and it did not fail to deliver. Let's wrap up the show. Actually, before we do that, I do think that we should have this conversation again and perhaps bring on someone on the other side of this issue, because it is really important. And I wanted to continue having this dialogue. Let's tell our listeners something they don't know now to cap the show. Catherine, what is your story this week?
Yeah, so since we had Katie Fehrenbacher on last week, and she was terrific, she posted a story this week titled "Wow, the U.S. Built More Solar Than Natural Gas Last Year" on Fortune. And certainly this has a lot to do with Green Tech Media because it is a teaser to the Solar Insight Market Report that you all do. SEIA also is part of that, the Solar Energy Industry Association. And it says that the report's saying that solar supplied 29.5% of the new energy sources built last year. So it's pretty significant and says something that even with the uncertainty of the tax credit issue, that solar is going like gangbusters.
Yeah, obviously we're working from a very small generation base when you look at actual electrons produced compared to natural gas on the grid. I think natural gas is somewhere around 27% of electricity produced in the U.S., and solar is somewhere around just over 1%. But it is an important milestone. We thought it was really important to mention, and solar is going gangbusters. In fact, this week on The Interchange, on our GTM Squared podcast, Shale and I break down the numbers in that report, so you can listen to that if you're a member. Jigar, what is your story this week?
As many people know, we've been following the story in Flint, Michigan, where it's just a tragedy that so many children are going to be damned for their entire lives because of the lead in that water. And, so I looked a lot into the water industry. And, interestingly enough, since 1990, water prices have actually gone down by 10% after taking into account inflation. And so there actually is enough money in the system to solve all these problems and to fix all this aging infrastructure. We just have to figure out a way to get folks to pay more for water. I mean, just keeping up with inflation so that there's enough money to solve the problem. And Flint, Michigan, to change out the lead pipes is only about $55 million, which is not a lot of money when you talk about infrastructure. And so it's an interesting thing where, I mean, it does probably cost $1 trillion to fix all of the water infrastructure in the country, but we actually have the money if we just let water bills keep up with inflation.
Yeah, and the Senate is trying to get them some funding diverted out of the alternative vehicles program, and they're still kind of hashing that out in the Senate, but hopefully they'll come to agreement soon.
All right, I have one last little promotional thing here. So if you follow GTM, you read and hear a lot about the grid edge, and this is the term we use to talk about the intersection of the utility and the distribution grid, the customer, and distributed energy technologies. And this is a way for us to identify in a tangible way where changes are happening fastest and where they're going to have the biggest impact on revenues. As part of the development of that concept, we rolled out the Grid Edge Council, currently 100 members with 30 utilities. And being a member gets you high-level private meetings with top thinkers and vendors and utilities and other business leaders, and also to our Grid Edge research. So this week we rolled out the Grid Edge Customer Network for commercial and industrial customers. And if you're in the C&I sector, you're increasingly having to make complex decisions about how to manage energy use. So we're taking this concept that we developed around the Grid Edge Council and we're applying it to a different class of folks, the energy customers themselves. So as a member of that network, you'd get access to like the Grid Edge network that we've established, our research, and high-level meetings with other companies that are facing similar challenges. So if you're interested in joining that network, just shoot an email to sales@greentechmedia.com, or you can find out more by going to greentechmedia.com/customer network. That is all. Thanks for joining us, folks. We're available where all podcasts are aggregated: iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Overcast, or any podcast app of your choice. We always look forward to your emails. You can contact us at podcasts@greentechmedia.com and send any feedback, comments, story ideas, etc. Catherine, talk to you soon. Have a good week and weekend.
Thanks, you too.
Jigar, talk to you later.
Always a pleasure sparring with you.
With Jigar Shah and Catherine Hamilton, I'm Stephen Lacey, and we are the Energy Gang. We'll catch you next week.